You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Tuesday, the 20th of June, All Marine Radio continues. Joining me is Richard Sisk, and while we were talking before coming on the air, found out that he hails from the great empire of Brooklyn, New York. So, Richard, first of all, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
No, it's a privilege. First of all, so we're talking, exchanging pleasantries. He tells me he's from Brooklyn. Brooklyn's void of anything but a basketball team these days. So I said Mets or Yankees. He said, it's a long story.
Wait a minute. Did you say devoid? Devoid of anything? Come on.
Devoid of anything athletic? Other than that basketball team you guys got going, where Jay-Z put in there, and so I'm sure it's a cultural mecca. We know that. I won't deny that. And so he says, "Oh, I go way back. Born in 1944. Tell them growing up in the 50s in Brooklyn and going to the Dodger game. It's an awesome story."
The old Brooklyn Dodgers were the be all and end all for us kids growing up there. We lived on the other side of the park from Ebbets Field, and just a great experience. Even though every year they lose to the Yankees, with the exception of 1955, and that was when Brooklyn became the world champions for the first and only time, and then the great divide, the great fall, when they went to the West Coast with the Giants in 1957, and that left a big hole in Brooklyn, left a big hole in the city, sort of came back with the Mets in 1962. So I'm sort of a heavy Mets fan, but the Yankees, when they had their resurgence, so the way a lot of us feel about it is New York against the world, as always. And so the Yankees are going okay, I'm with them, but ultimately a Mets fan, particularly when they play the Yankees, which is, of course, the steel cage death match.
The Yankees, a little bit different kind of a baseball team this year, young and a little bit more interesting than they've been in a long time.
Quite a transformation. And have you seen this big kid, Aaron Judge?
Oh, my
wow.
God, he's incredible. And he seems to be a genuinely warm, nice human being, adopted by his parents were both teachers. He seems to be, I don't want everybody compares him to Derek Jeter. I don't know that anybody would want to walk in those footsteps because of how he handled himself so well for so long and in such a spotlight. But he seems like a genuinely nice young man, and have an incredible success, and he can hit it where nobody hits it. He tried to hit one out of Yankee Stadium, what, a week ago?
Yeah, and
almost did.
Yeah, they're just monster shots. There are all kinds of new statistics now.
Right.
Launch angle and
exit velocity.
And the speed at which the, exit velocity, is that the term of art?
That's what we're calling it.
Yeah, and somebody had something where, I guess Judge had the highest exit velocity ever recorded, something like 121 miles per hour, which, wow.
He's got.
However, I have to point out to you that that's about That's about the speed of a Serena Williams first serve.
Right. To put it in context, all right. All right.
Yeah.
Just so nobody gets carried away here. All right, we need to learn about you before we talk about the subject at hand. Born and raised, obviously, in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
All right. Go to college where?
I went to Le Moyne College in Syracuse, New York, a little Jesuit school.
All right. So you're a Catholic kid?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, grew up that way.
That's a good sign, as am I. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, my older brother was Marine, enlisted, and served during the Korean War. He didn't get into Korea. He got as far as Japan. But he did a couple of years, and so there was that. Like so many others, I was trying to play ball. I thought I was a ball player.
Ah.
And I was a catcher and briefly played, ever so briefly, ever so badly.
Where did you play?
The low minor leagues. It doesn't exist anymore. There was a Canadian Provincial League. We played in a little town called Tetford Mines, which is 70 miles west of Quebec City, if you can imagine anything being 70 miles west of Quebec City.
I can.
And so I was up there one summer, 65, 66, and didn't do too well. Came back, and I tried law school. Wasn't smart enough for that.
Uh-huh.
And then came the draft notice. And okay, what now? So decided. Rather than do that, I joined the Marine Corps. And was sent to OCS early 67. And from OCS straight to basic school June of 67.
All right, so you were an OCC guy. So you went to OCS and then straight through. The salt of the earth, I might add, are the OCC classes. So you do the Marine Corps. And then, when did you get out of the Marine Corps?
70, 71. They were really out. Just about all of us from TBS, from the basic school. We went to Vietnam, and all different units, and. I was hit, I guess I got there, early December, 67.
Okay.
And, assigned to, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, Fox Company.
The magnificent bastards, as they love to be known.
That's it.
A
lot of stories about how that name came about, but
We'll get to that. But you get out of the Marine Corps, and then how do you find your way to journalism, which has been your career for 40 years?
Sheer luck, happenstance. it was talk about aimless. So I was back from Vietnam and in 70, 71. And had no idea what I was doing. Went to graduate school for a little while. Then I did a crazy thing, got married.
Uh-huh.
And she had a great job here in D.C. And we were down here. And, what was I going to do? Well, I like to write stories. Maybe there's a job there, and literally went around the this is ridiculous, went around the National Press Building knocking on doors, my little resume in my hand. I get thrown out of various places, and the last one I came to was the New York Daily News. And they were in the process of throwing me out as well. And this nasty old guy came over and said, "Who the hell are you?" By this time, I was fed up. I said, "Who the hell are you?" And just showed him the resume, and all he saw was Marine Corps. And it turned out he was a retired Marine colonel. And he said, "You know how to type?" I said, "No." And he said, "Well, the hell with it. You want to be a copy boy?" I said, "Okay." And so that started my career in journalism. And from there, they were instrumental in getting the job on the city desk in New York at United Press International. And that was glorious. Chasing cops and fire trucks and ambulances, and went from there. And I've been in the news business ever since.
The so New York Daily News, and now writing for military.com?
Yeah, I worked for the Wires for about 10 years, and then after that, the New York Daily News. And was lucky enough to get a bunch of assignments. Overseas, covering sometimes covering presidential campaigns. I worked out of the Washington Bureau of the New York Daily News for a long time, and then downsizing, outsizing, all of that sort of stuff, and getting old. So I was gone from the New York Daily News for a while. Myself and another colleague were trying to do a blog. We were in Afghanistan with the troops for a while, and then that didn't work. And came back, and I was lucky enough to land with military.com, and been there for the past 2 years, 3 years.
A recent article caught my eye. Mattis hasn't decided to send 4,000 more troops to Afghanistan. Contrary to everything else that's been reported, figures the Marine would actually get it right, so congratulations on that deal.
That was curious. General Mattis, last week from Monday through Thursday, he was up there testifying. In fact, like General Dunford said right. Yesterday, total something like 18 hours.
Right.
And at various things, and he had said, General Mattis had said repeatedly during the course of his testimony that he was looking at Afghanistan and trying to figure something new in the way of strategy. Talking about a regional approach to the whole situation, working with Secretary Tillerson, and he said repeatedly, under some intense questioning from Senator McCain, that it was a work in progress, and he'd probably come up with something around the middle of July. And then there were reports surfaced, I guess it was Wednesday, that a Trump administration official, unnamed, had said that Mattis had signed off on 4,000 additional troops. And the next day, the Pentagon put out a statement. It was about two paragraphs saying that, no, it's not so. General Mattis had not made up his mind yet, and it was still a work in progress, and something that he would present to the president in mid-July, as he had been suggesting all week long. and that's where it stands. And it's still up in the air on what exactly it will be. Although it appears there will be some additional troops going to Afghanistan on top of the force management level now at 8,400.
Right. Right. No, I thought it was interesting. You were the only one that has written that headline. Written that story. Everybody else was that the 4,000 already had, mm-hmm. you know, that decision had already been made. And I thought the chairman yesterday in front of the National Press Club was pretty, I think he did a good job of laying out, you know, the timeline for the strategy and where that number 4,000 had come from, but that no decision had been made. I had a chance to serve with him in Iraq, and what a pretty
under
General Mattis. I was Mattis's staff sec, and General Dunford was the chief of staff, and General Kelly was the assistant mm-hmm. division commander. And so, pretty interesting experience. The three working with on a day-to-day basis, shoulder to shoulder with those guys, and to get to see them up close under pressure, the way they led, the way they took care of themselves, so that they could contribute in extremely intense, you know, operations on a daily basis. The discipline they have as human beings to do that kind of stuff. But interesting, three pretty interesting guys and pretty interesting places they've landed now. So I love listening to them speak and articulate a vision for the country. And hopefully they'll do good things. But no, I thought he was great yesterday at the National Press Club. So I want to switch gears. I want to talk now about. So that's you. That's you in kind of the pattern of your life.
First, can I tell you something about General Mattis? From a former reporter's side, it's so impressive. I do not know General Mattis. I've asked him a question on one time or another, but as far as, you know, like, coming down the hallway in the Pentagon with him saying hi, Rich, or something, like, no. And I've never traveled with him. But, the thing that, from a reporter's side, maybe this is me blowing smoke, but, what is so impressive is at times he will say in response to a question, I don't know, but I'll get back to you. And for someone to say that out loud, someone in his position, someone in this town, you never ever say, I don't know. you just keep talking and spinning and stuff like that, but, I really believe it speaks to his integrity that he has the self-confidence to do that.
Now, you know, and it's interesting, that's what he expects you to say when you don't know. The worst thing that you could possibly do with him in some kind of briefing, because normally he knows more than you, is when he asks you a question is to try to dance with him. And I used to walk in before he would brief, and I'd say, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know, do not dance with him because he will harpoon you in front of everybody. Okay? If you don't know, look at him and say, sir, I don't know, I will find out. And he'll write your name down. He'll put a little box next to your name that you owe him, and he will write what you owe him and get it to him as quick as he can. Everybody understand? But there would always be, most of the time, somebody who wanted to dance. And it did not.
No, oh boy.
It did not turn out well. No, I mean he would be initially gracious, and then boom, he would end it. He's a smart guy, but he believes it. He is a jihadist. I mean he doesn't say things he doesn't mean. I have that little soundbite. What keeps you awake at night? Nothing. I keep other people awake at night, and that's him. And he doesn't say it for effect.
Yeah.
Not looking for a rim shot. He understands the role of the military in our democracy, and he believes it with all of his heart and all of his integrity. So he's an interesting guy. Let's talk about you and your TBS class. you know, fate. We could do this for we could do other things for an hour, but fate looms on the horizon as you young lieutenants assemble in Quantico. I think at one of the greatest schools in the United States military, which binds all officers together, those of us who've gone through and become officers, we all go to the same place. We do mostly the same things at that school for year after year after year, and we're learning the lessons that create Marine officers. But fate would be looming for you in terms of late 1967 and 1968, a pretty violent time in the Republic of Vietnam. You get out, you leave the basic school, and are you an infantry officer by MOS, or what were you?
Yeah, that was one of the things that sort of astounded a lot of the guys at the reunion, the 50th reunion. That was over the weekend of June 2nd. They were good enough to do TBS did a briefing for us on the school on TBS and how it's changed and changed in some ways except for the core mission after the briefing was done by the XO of the school, there were some questions, and so one of the questions was, what's sort of the breakdown on the MOS of the young officers that that graduate now from TBS? And he said about 15% infantry. And everybody sort of gasped at that because nearly all of us were infantry. So, you know, there were a few that went to artillery school after TBS, a few went to the air wing. But almost all, there were 498 of us, two companies and company in November company and Oscar company. And just about all of us were infantry, upwards of 70%. So that was one of the stats that amazed us. What you were saying, Mike, was that was so it was pointed out to us that perhaps that's one of the differences. Beginning everybody knew that's where we're going to Vietnam. Not so much so for the new generation.
Right, no, a little bit different. The when you look at, I'm curious as you guys look back now in the long lens of history. I'm curious to know your thoughts about the whole mental health thing because, you know, there was no PTSD diagnosis. You guys were young guys. You grew up in the shadow of World War II. You grew up in the shadow of Korea. And this Vietnam thing was your turn, you know, it was your time to take your turn and do what your father, your uncle, your neighbors had all done, guys older than you in school had done. And do your part. As you look back now over the course of time, how has your group fared relative to post-combat related mental health? Has it been a bit mixed bag? Because I don't know that there's been a tougher road to walk down than in terms of post-combat related mental health than the one that the Vietnam veteran has walked down. How have you guys done? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, as you said, Mike, there wasn't an awful lot of attention put to that. What are the after effects of being in combat, and how does that translate into the return of civilian life? I guess it was mostly ignored. People with problems it was straighten up and, you know, get your head out of your watches and let's go forward. It was something, there were suicides among us. And you can, even trace circumstances of how that happened, how it might have been avoided should somebody have been, more open about what they were experiencing. But, it was, one of the things that got me, during the course of reporting, in 2-4, while I was there, there were two recipients of the Medal of Honor, Captain Jay Vargas and, Captain Jim Livingston, who became
Captain Livingston. Jay Vargas and Jim Livingston were both in your company?
They were company commanders in other companies. That was Fox Company.
In the battalion.
Echo and Hotel.
Wow.
At Dino.
Holy shit.
But there was, you know, yet another study. It was by a bunch of retired officers, and it was. On the whole subject of mental health, and General Livingston, then retired, had been part of the group that submitted the report. And there was some congressional hearings, and the first time I'd seen him since Vietnam, you know, talking to him about it. And I was surprised because you want to talk about hardcore Marines, that's Jim Livingston.
Yep.
But he said, you know, I talked to him afterwards, and this report was, you know, yet another, and it sits on a shelf somewhere, and whether anybody ever paid any attention to it, I don't know. And talking to him afterwards, and he said that he thought after Dido, it probably would have been good if somehow he and his troops could somehow have stepped aside for a minute, day, a month, and just talked about, sort out what they had gone through, and. I thought that was something somebody of his stature would say that.
Just for people that don't know, Dido happens. It goes on, I don't know, for the better part of a few months, and ends in early May, and 81 Marines are killed in the battle, and over 600 enemy are killed in the battle. Pretty amazing. You know, you talk about numbers that we, you know, the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans look at and go, you got to be kidding me. Those kind of casualties, like, holy shit, what must have that have been like? And simply amazing. So again, my name.
Oh, Mike. First for the record, I was not there.
Right. No. I understand.
There was a lead up to things had been building up, and you know, you could sense something big was going to happen.
Okay. So hold on. And, so my guess is Richard Sisk. He's a longtime journalist. New York Daily News, now military.com. But he was a lieutenant in 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, 1968, and in Vietnam. And they just had a reunion. Their basic school class suffered over 50% casualties, which is more than any nobody's even close to that relative to other basic school classes. But he gracious enough to join us this morning, and because they just had a reunion, he wrote about it. I saw the article and gave him a call, and so gracious enough to share with us a little bit of his time. So you go to Vietnam. What part of Vietnam is 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines operating in?
It was all in the DMZ. We were first place I was at was along the Quad Yet, the river that comes in from the coast, runs down to Dong Ha. We were there in January.
Okay. So January of 68?
Yeah. We were withdrawn for about a week. I got on the ships that took us back to the Philippines to refit, and we became a special landing force back to Vietnam, in the same area. And we got off the ships and never got back on the ships again. But I just wanted to say, to be clear, Mike, I was not at the battle at Dai Do. In the lead up to that, there was action was building up, and I was hit in a firefight and evacuated back to Japan. And then Dido occurred, and sent back in, and it was really difficult to go back into the Regina Fox Company. I hardly knew anyone anymore. They were all gone after Dido.
Right.
And so it was wow. It was like starting over again.
Talk to me about as you guys have come together. First of all, I think it's interesting just about Vietnam. I've learned more about Vietnam since starting the show a year ago. Depending on what year you were there, depending on where you were at, the war is incredibly different. So it's almost like turning a kaleidoscope, you know. In 67, you're talking about up by the DMZ when Carl Marlanus is there. I want to say maybe a year or so later, they're in the Central Highlands, up there, up and down mountains, and fighting. What about that time when you look back and you think of the casualties that your basic school suffered? Was it simply the level of fighting that everybody was going to become a grunt? Because now basic school classes, I want to say, are between 200 and 300. I taught there in 1990, 91, 92. Between 200 and 300, your class twice that size. And as you said, maybe, you know, you might see of that 300 officer class, you might see 35 or so. So maybe 15%. Or so are going to become infantry officers. When you guys look back on it, was it simply what fate had in store for you guys in Vietnam? As you try to, I think we all look for rational explanations for things that happen in life. How do you guys explain it?
Yeah, how do you explain it? Actually, Mike, you can't, and you have to live with that.
Do you think that's the hardest thing to accept, Richard, is there is no explanation, and that these things that are so life-changing, life-ending, you know, for some, life-defining for others, and you want there to be an explanation, and the bottom line is that there isn't an explanation. Do you think that's one of the hardest things to accept?
Yeah. I try to get at it a little bit in the story I did on the reunion, and this is not like it, you know, nobody's ever said it before, but one of the things that we've had previous reunions, and one of the things that always got me was, you know, at some point during, you know, get together, a ceremony, whatever would happen at the reunion. It would be one or two of the guys, at one point would get up and, read off the names of those killed. Mm-hmm. And it would take a while. And, just over and over the drumbeat of the names. And, what you think about, why am I here and they're not? That question has no answer. As it happenstance, as some of the other guys point out, or we all do, it's why am I here? It's because of those Lance Corporals and PFCs who carried my butt through the damn war. And that's true. It's something there that lingers, that never goes away, and you can't answer it. Yeah. One of the, another thing that always, you end up arguing about the Chow and things like that, or, the M16, versus the M14, and, yelling at each other, this, that, or the other thing, but, you touched on it before, Mike. One of the things is that you can't even agree on how things were done, how things were approached, in the sense that I was 3rd Marine Division, so that was up north. I was on the DMZ, and you're basically talking free fire zone. And for me to talk to somebody who was in the 1st Marine Division further south,
right,
it's an entirely different thing.
Right.
They were dealing much, 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 much more with booby traps, with other things, different terrain. And, for us to talk about how did you move, how did you deploy your people, where did you put your gun, what did you do with this, what did you do with that? And it's entirely different, as it would work out. Some of the things, you learned at basic school, just didn't apply as to how you had to, work with your platoon given the missions that you were given. And it's almost like talking to, for me to talk to a 1st Marine Division guy, how he operated, and the 3rd Marine Division guy. It's like different planets. It's like you're in different countries.
Right. Now, when you hear somebody say Da Nang, it's a completely different world than when somebody says Dong Ha, when somebody says
Kantian.
Kaesong. Yeah, Kaesong. Yeah. When you talk about the way they lived, I had a chance to, interview. There's. I don't know if you've seen it, but
Kaesong Trench Warfare. That's what you're talking about.
You see the? There's a video out done. It's called Bravo, and it's done by a guy named Ken Rogers who lives in Idaho, who was at Kaesong, and it's an incredible documentary. It's called Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor, and it is absolutely astounding to just watch it. What they lived with on a daily basis and how those guys could ever be right in the head is beyond me after what they did. But that story and that narrative you could apply. I had Carl Marlanis on and he talked about, he tells this really funny story about he's been in Vietnam for a couple weeks. Now they're in the north central highlands. So they're up and down mountain chasing the NVA. And then they bump into them. They napalm the shit out of the mountains to get it bare so they can see. And then they blast it. And then they attack it. And that's the way they live. That's what they do. He said it was just absolutely brutal. He said they're cleaning weapons after a couple weeks. And he said, I'd proven that I was going to be okay to my Marines in my platoon. So we're cleaning weapons, and one of them comes up to him, one of my Lance Corporal squad leaders, he said, who was probably like 20 at the time, and I think his name was Chase or something like that. He said, "Sir, can I ask you a question?" He said, the other Marines are kind of watching this with one eye, and I said, "Yeah, what's up?" He says, is it true that you're a Rhodes Scholar? And Marlana said, I looked at him and he said, I said, that you went to Yale and you're a Rhodes Scholar. And he said, yeah, Chase, that's true. And he says, he looks at me and says, sir, you got to be the dumbest fucking Rhodes Scholar in the history of the world. And Marlana said, everybody laughs, right? And he said, we're clean of rifles. And I looked up at him and said, you know what? You could probably make that case. And, but the story he tells of, you know, of that war, as opposed to, you know, I've had different general officers on, and just not because they're general officers, because they write or they speak and they get on my radar and then they enjoy the conversation, so they come back. And General Tom Drouty, his experience was around Da Nang, fighting the Viet Cong, and in a completely different experience than the one you all had up near the DMZ, which is and then the whole Hue City thing is a different chapter in it in terms of urban. Now we go from this fight to this other fight. But you know, the thing I find that I think most interesting is, I've been to Iraq twice and Afghanistan once, and when the God who governs the flight of metal through the air, I say, is a fickle God. He doesn't answer prayers. He doesn't smite you for being a scumbag. And he marches, or she marches, to whatever drum they have, and it's a drum beat that has no rhythm. It's simply a fickle drum beat, and why somebody lives. But I think that is, you know, what you know, until you accept that, and that's one of the reasons I think that in Band of Brothers, there's that lieutenant by the name of Spears, and he says to a guy named Albert Blythe, who has panic-induced blindness, and he says at one point, he says, Blythe, you have to accept that you're already dead in order for you to function here. If you don't accept that, you'll never be able to function. And I think that's a different, his own interpretation and way of articulating that concept that, you know what, once you go, it's pretty much largely out of your hands. You can't duck in time. You're not going to hear it coming. Mm-hmm. And if you're fortunate enough to get back on the plane and go home, you know, it certainly wasn't because you were more skilled than other guys. It's because nothing hit you. And I think that's really a difficult thing to come to make peace with.
Yeah. You know, in some of the literature that's come out of Iraq and Afghanistan, not much, you know, by this point, but in some of it. And what strikes me about it is, you know, it's books, you know, there's Phil Clay, Marines, and some others. And I'm looking at my bookshelf now and trying to cite some others. But there's sort of an underlying current to it of sort of an acceptance that war is just this state of affairs, that it's this beast that's out there, and sometimes it comes to get you, and sometimes it doesn't. But that it's there, and you cope with it, you deal with it, you try to defeat it. But that it goes away sometimes, and then it comes back. But there it is. And you know, the great difference, you know, in my generation and yours is the existence of the draft.
Right.
And now it's all volunteer. And you know, one of the things that always strikes us when we have reunions and you mingle with the young Marines at TBS now. We hate to admit it, but number one, you guys are smarter than us.
Do you think so?
Oh yeah.
I don't.
And much more. I don't want to say dedicated, but what can I say, more intense about it. I don't know that there's, at least at the end, there's a great air of cynicism for us, heading into it.
Describe that. I'm because again, you grew up in the shadow of World War II. I mean, it was everywhere. You know, I was born in 57, and I know in the 60s, you know, the veterans from World War II, they were in their 40s and 50s for the most part. They were everywhere. Everyone was a veteran. And when you had a
veteran, there was the concept then that that wars had an end. And now we're going into 16 years in Afghanistan, and General Mattis is talking about a new strategy.
Dunford said yesterday in front of the National Press Club, he said this may be a generational conflict. He said, and I'm getting to the end of my career. He said, and it certainly won't be done, you know, in the end of my
in
my time. And so that is an interesting concept in terms of how warfare has changed. The cynicism, though, surprises me a little bit, because I would think you, at that age, you would have been a little bit more idealistic in terms of going to Vietnam to defeat this thing and come back and be in the parade like you had, kind of like you had grown up with.
Yeah. There was that. Hearts and minds. Helping a struggling country against invaders from the north and all of that. There was also, they came to be known as the 5 o'clock follies. I remember, you know, that once, we had, now this is me. Others might be different. A little concept of what was happening back home. You know, you hear about riots and Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, and so on. Get into your head, my God, what's happening? While I'm out here. And there was that, but my father worked, he loaded trucks at the New York Daily News, and sometimes he'd grab a bunch of the papers and send them over, and sometimes I'd get them. And at one point, I'd been hit in, mid-March, and I was back in Japan, and then I was back in Vietnam, and I was hit again in mid-June, and that was it. So my total time on the ground was about 4 months. So take with a grain of salt anything I say about the grand concept of the thing. But number one,
in all candor, we defer because of your two Purple Hearts. So whatever you had to say, we would listen to in spite of your 4 months, because you've seen a part of the world and lived an experience that most of us have not. And so while we accept your mea culpa of with 4 months, I think your two Purple Hearts earns you the right to say whatever the hell you want to, and for the rest of us to pay attention. Let me ask you, Richard.
I just want to tell you, Mike, about the things that would get bizarro. But remember, like receiving the papers, and there was stuff in there about they had started, or they were trying to get started some peace talks in Paris.
Right.
Well, North Vietnamese, but stories were saying they couldn't get started because, and this is true, they were arguing about the shape of the table.
Right.
Some of my troops said, they're arguing about the shape of the table.
And that went on forever. That went on for a long time.
Yeah. So I said, yeah. And, you know, and one of my troops looked at me and said, you got to be shitting me.
Right. Right. We're out here dying.
Yeah, yeah. And,
we in Iraq, we didn't have enough people. We didn't have enough guys to fight in 2004. And, you know, you'd see Don Rumsfeld get up in a press conference and he'd be asked that. And he said, they have everything they need. They have more than enough. And you're sitting there watching it thinking, you gotta be shitting me. You know? Okay. Here we go. Let's go play whack-a-mole. And, pretty discouraging. When you guys, not that many organizations, that are as loosely configured as a basic school class. I mean, you're together for 6 months and it's not like you're in combat together, although you certainly were in combat with some of your peers. You guys have kind of hung together for such a long period of time. Are there lessons from your class?
Lessons.
Are there things that the rest of us can learn from the journey that the basic school class of 667 went through?
Yep. One big one. One word. Listen. Don't go into listen. By that I mean listen to your troops. Listen to that squad leader. Listen to that sergeant. Doesn't mean you gotta, as a lieutenant, doesn't mean, that you're gonna follow what they say. But hear it. Take the time to hear it. Every day, it was patrols every day. You'd be given checkpoints and so on. And, okay, here we go. And, he grabbed your unit and say, look, we're going here, this and this. This is what I want to take. This is how I want to do it. If you have time, if you have a chance, look at him, say, okay, this is what I think we should do. What do you think? I think that was, that may have been a fault with some of us that, we didn't listen. You're in it together. You're supposed to lead your platoon. But, my God, take into account what they might think about something. What they might think about how you're going to deploy. What they might think about how you're going to approach problems. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to, take it into account. However, the idea that you did listen means an awful lot, or at least that's what I quickly discovered.
The basic school class of 667 had the highest casualty rate that I've ever heard of. And my guest this morning, Richard Sisk, has put off going to work to talk to us. So, Richard, I hope if you don't mind, if on occasion I call you up to bug you about things you've written or maybe leadership subjects or get your observations. I've enjoyed the visit, to be honest with you.
Mike, it'd be my pleasure.
I have to tell you, my dad managed the Boston Red Sox in 1986.
right away, I don't like him.
Oh, well, trust me. 1986, when the ball went through Bill Buckner's legs. Yeah, I was sitting in Shea Stadium that night. And I tell people, if something like that is ever going to darken your doorstep, pray to God it happens in Kansas City or Minnesota, in Minnesota, someplace where people are Midwestern friendly. The last thing you want to really experience is the number 7 train after when you're on the losing side of it, and you think it's going to leave the rails because the people are going to rock it off because they're so excited. So, yeah, I'm not so much a Mets fan or even a Red Sox fan. I'm actually a Yankee fan. I was a Yankee fan growing up. Mickey Mantle was on the Game of the Week with Dizzy Dean and I think Kurt Dowdy, or I think at the time. And, you know, there was one game you got to watch on a weekly basis Saturday morning out on the West Coast. And Mickey Mantle was the guy. And then I followed my dad's teams. And then I soured on baseball, honestly. In the aftermath of the 86 World Series, Peter Gammons blamed the loss on my dad. And the truth is...
Oh, brother.
Yeah, well, the truth is, in the seventh inning... Roger Clemens told my dad, I've got, you know, you need to bring in Calvin Schiraldi. He said, I'm running out of gas and I've got the start of a paper cut on my finger, right? Well, Clemens never owned up to saying it. He said, I never took myself out of that game. Well, and after that, he wins the Cy Young and the MVP. And then Gammons hammers my dad in Sports Illustrated and my dad doesn't handle
it. Oh, brother.
Yeah, my dad doesn't handle it very well. And then it's open season on my dad because Gammon's minions in Boston, I mean, they're legions of them. And it was a very unpleasant experience as they ran my dad out of the city. And then, you know, and it was interesting as his son, I'm a lieutenant in the Marine Corps, you know the truth because, you know, like since I was a little boy, after ball games, I ride home with my dad, go in the locker room, hang out, ride home with my dad, we talk about the game. That game, game six, was no different. Why did you take Clemens out? And he looked at me and said, I didn't take him. He said, I didn't take him out. He said he was running out of gas and he had the start of a paper cut.
Wow.
That's long before it became, you know, became history. And then to watch it. And ultimately, Clemens got his due, you know, the whole steroids and, you know, making himself look like an idiot and, you know, relative to Congress and things like that. And then the world learns that, oh, my God, he's a liar. But I could have told him that. I could have told him that in 1987.
You remember? Remember Boston? You know, there were people running around with big signs, McNamara's band.
Oh my God! Yeah, no, yeah, no. And again, Irish Catholic, going to Boston. And I'll tell you what: in 2004, when they came back and beat the Yankees in the playoffs and then won the World Series, I'm in Iraq. Dunford is a Red Sox. You know, he died in the war. Red Sox.
Oh God! Yeah. Yeah.
Our Sergeant Major, another Boston guy, they were everywhere, and they would not shut up. But, again, you know what, my heart was heavy because watching it, my thought was, you know what, this should have belonged. Two outs, nobody on, bottom of the ninth, Shea Stadium, 1986. And you're up by two runs. That game, you don't lose that game. That's an act of divine intervention. I told my dad, we're Catholic, you should never divorce mom. God didn't go for that. You know what I'm saying? And
you know the great quote from Billy Buckner about a week or two after that epic game, you know, when Mookie Wilson levitated and then hit the ground ball. So somebody, one of the sports writers, talking to Billy and said, well, how did you handle it? And Billy said, well, I decided to end it all. And I went out on Commonwealth Ave, and I stood there right in front of the trolley, and here came the trolley. And so the guy asked, well, what happened? Billy said, went right through my legs.
You know what? He's a great guy, and was a great player. My dad said, you know, at the end of the day,
he
misses the ball, you know. And he said, look, he said, it's on me if he doesn't get to it. You know, I got that. He said, but you know, he gets there and he misses it. And he said, look, we had Game Seven, and we were up in Game Seven too, and we didn't hold on to that. He said, but that there's only one play that everybody remembers. And I'll tell you what, then he was one of the great hitters of that era and did it on bad legs and, you know, routinely would drive in the 100 runs. But I would watch him. I'd go early to the stadium with my dad when I was, you know, at that time I'm in the Marine Corps. So I'd you know, take a Friday off and come see him and go to ball games with him. And you know, I'd get to the stadium early. I'd work out. I'd go for a run and things like that. And Buckner would be there you know, at 2:33 in the afternoon, with a copy of the Boston Herald, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, the New York Daily News. He'd have a stack of papers when he'd have both ankles in ice, both shoulders in ice, and it was just what he would do to get ready to play. And then he'd go out and play, and he played like a man. He was a stud. So it was sad to see the way the city turned on him, and they've rectified that here in recent years. But it was certainly painful until they won and were able to be magnanimous about it. So anyway. Well, Richard, I will let you go to work. First of all, thank you very much for doing this. Now, the story of your basic school class is, you know, as I see it, it's a rendezvous with fate. And I think it's very interesting that you guys have still get together after all these years to honor your classmates. And there's a memorial. There's a sculpture at the basic school. Yes.
Yeah, it's been there. I guess 6-7 years, it was dedicated at a previous reunion we had. I think it was 07.
And it's right outside. It's right outside Graves Hall, if I'm not mistaken. Yes.
Yeah, a short walk.
Right. There's a whole walkway of commemorative monuments in that area. Yes, I think.
Kerry was a ball player too. Terry Graves.
I saw that.
Played at Miami of Ohio, and I guess the Reds had come down to take a look. But Terry was recovering. I'm calling him Terry. I really didn't know him. He was in. We were in separate companies, and I do recall once somehow he knew I was a catcher. And he had been a catcher, and I don't know, in passing or something like that. We talked about baseball once, and I know he was a good guy because we both agreed that the curveball was a foul, evil contrivance, and whoever invented it should be court-martialed.
Whenever I served at the, you know, I taught at the basic school, and then you read the citation of, you know, it's Terrence Graves on this, Graves on the citation, on the monument. And I have a son actually who's serving there now. He's a captain. He's a staff platoon commander there. And, you read that, what he did. And you shake your head, you know, that whole thing, you know, where do we get such men? I remember seeing, you know, both the monument you guys put up and certainly Graves Hall is something that if you're a Marine officer, you've spent time in and you've certainly read his story. So on behalf of the rest of us, you know, to you and your base school class, you know, the term that comes to my mind is genuflect. Out of simply respect for your contribution and what you guys did, I just want to give you kudos for writing about it, keeping it in our memory, because that number, it's really hard to fathom that half of a basic school class and a basic school class of almost 500. Would become casualties in Vietnam, and it's a testament to the kind of lieutenants that the Marine Corps puts out, their leaders, and they don't shrink from it. And we've done that for a long, long time. And your class has written a bit of history about it. And so Richard, again, thanks for doing this. Enjoyed the conversation. We'll bring you back on again, and we'll only talk about baseball.
All the fair, Mike, and. Thanks an awful lot for having me. Good to talk to you.
All right. All right. Have a good day. Thank you. Wow. That is Richard Sisk. You can find the article on at military.com. And pretty interesting. Think about that. Let me get the exact number. The exact number of 498 lieutenants in that basic school class. By the end of the year, nearly all of them were in Vietnam. The TBS class begins in June, so it runs, what, June to November. The first lieutenant to be killed in Vietnam was Second Lieutenant Michael Ruane, R-U-A-Ruane, of Mike Company, 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, December 18th, 1967. Probably in Vietnam for less than a month. Amazing. Yeah, it's certainly interesting. And so in 1967, you know, you had some of the biggest battles, and 1968, some of the biggest battles of the war. But if you go to the basic school, if you're ever in Quantico and you go back to the basic school, you'll see it's a beautiful monument. It's shaped, there's part of it shaped in a V, and then there's another, I think there's another piece of it, or it might be the back of the monument that has all their names on it. And then if you've never heard the story of Terrence Graves, Terry Graves, as Richard talks about him, Graves led I'll read from the article. He leads a small unit from 3rd Recon, Team Box Score, he was a baseball guy, in the area of Quang Tri Province, called Leatherneck Square, bounded by its strong points, Gio Linh, Con Tien, Cam Lo, and Dong Ha. They ambushed a patrol of North Vietnamese Army regulars, but more NVA rushed to the scene. Graves and his men fought them off and then pulled back to a medevac helicopter. He put his wounded aboard, but was told that one of his men was not accounted for. Graves screamed at the crew chief, "Get out of here." He headed back to the fight. As the helicopter began to lift off, one of his Marines jumped out to join him, according to his citation. But other accounts, there were two. The lieutenant would not leave anyone behind. They would not leave their lieutenant behind. They went back into the firefight, which built into ferocity as Marine reinforcements arrived. The citation stated, confronted with a shortage of ammunition, Second Lieutenant Graves utilizing supporting arms and directed fire until a second helicopter arrived. At this point, the volume of enemy fire intensified, killing the helicopter, hitting the helicopter, and causing it to crash shortly after liftoff. All aboard were killed. Second Lieutenant Graves' outstanding courage, superb leadership, indomitable fighting spirit throughout the day were in keeping with the highest traditions of the Marine Corps, the United States Navy. He gallantly gave his life for his country. There's another version of it, a bit more detailed, on the Force Recon Association website. So again, that's 667 from the basic school. Also famous out of that were Colonel Higgins, that was captured in Lebanon, was part of that class as well. So amazing story. And again, the other very cool part of the story is the fact that they've hung together for so long as a group. So there's also, if you go to the Force Recon Association, there's Graves' picture, his Medal of Honor citation. There's a monument to him, I guess in his hometown of Groton, New York, Groton. And then there's a long letter, a narrative, written by by Michael Lanning and Ray Stubbe. Wow. It's a pretty long, detailed account of... holy smoke. Of their contact that day. Wow. Pretty amazing. Anyway, we're going to take a break. Comments from the Chairman, Joint Chiefs of Staff. Actually, you know what? We might roll that till tomorrow. We're going to take a break, a much overdue break. And then, we'll probably check the news of the day. And then the gunner will join us. And we'll hear the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's comments tomorrow. Let me just tell you, amazing stuff. Listening to General Dunford talk. And what he does is he paints with a much broader paintbrush than most writers paint with these days. And so it's great for all of us to listen to him because of the picture that he paints for us in terms of Syria, in terms of the restraint we show. So it's just, again, I'm a huge fan, certainly, because I served with him. In my opinion, he does such a great job at articulating for the American people what we're doing it, you know, how we're trying to do it, the restraint we show with it, how we're trying to do it with our coalition partners in the region. I think that's the one thing that I got out of it most was our coalition partners in the region and how we're trying to manage these conflicts in addition to all of our other commitments around the world. And what seems to be our recipe, our approach to make this work well. The little sound clips you heard from the National Press Club luncheon yesterday don't nearly do the Q&A answer enough justice, because it was way better. It was way better than the little clips that you heard. So anyway, we'll take a quick break. We'll check the news as we continue on a Tuesday. But again, his name, Richard Sisk. If you do a search on Richard Sisk, Military Times, you'll see a whole series of his articles that come up, and awesome stuff. Wounded twice, as he said. I was in Vietnam for a total of 4 months with 2 Purple Hearts. Yeah, it gives you some sense of, you know, you don't get those not at the point of contact. So, the sixth class of fiscal year 67 has a memorial at the basic school. It suffered more than 250 casualties, including 43 officers killed in action in Vietnam. Imagine that. Imagine that. Yeah, it's hard to. It's hard to. Yeah. In fact, when we come back, I'm going to read you pieces of the letter that they write about Terrence Gray, Terry Gray, baseball player. Yeah, Terrence. It sounds so antiseptic, right? Terry Gray, Terrence Gray. So we'll come back, take a break. We'll come back. We'll do this. We'll check a few news headlines, and then the gunner will join us. So more of Almarin Radio takes place here on a Tuesday on the All Warrior Radio Network. Whatever you do, do not touch that dial.